Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. I seek refuge, protection with Allah from Satan, the rejected enemy. With Allah's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. Today is November 21st, 2021. You're listening to Words Made People. I'm your host, Michael Sahir. Our topic today will be speaking on Muslims who were falsely accused of killing our brother, Elhaj Malik al-Shabazz, better known as Malcolm X, and they have finally been exonerated. So we're going to get into this conversation as deep as possible without disrespecting the family and the family connections with that. And we have a special guest coming on who knew Brother Khalil Islam, a.k.a. Thomas Johnson, Thomas 15X Johnson. And we're going to talk about that with those who knew him personally. So, alhamdulillah, we're going to get into that. But right now, we're going to play our opening theme song. And while our song is playing, call a friend. Tell your friend to tune in. This is a conversation for all of us, and you don't want to miss it. We'll be right back after our opening theme song. Assalamu alaikum.
Check out the words that make your world.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Words Made People. I'm your host, Michael Fly here. And we're here today for our exciting show, bringing my co-host from the West Coast, Imam Ayman Abdul Mujib. Assalamu alaikum, Aki.
Wa alaikum assalam, my dear brother. Glad to be here today. To all you and the radio listening audience, glad to be here. Alhamdulillah.
Yes, alhamdulillah. And we thank you, and thank you for your continuous support. Now, let me ask you if my voice coming in okay.
Yeah, we're good. We're good. You sound good. How do I sound on this end?
You sound fantastic. Alhamdulillah.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that I'm trying to do a hands-free operation because I plan to take a lot of good notes today. And I advise anybody listening, you may want to get a pencil and paper or ink. Get an ink pen. I want a pencil. We'll get an ink pen and some paper because there's going to be some good information coming today, I do believe, from our wonderful guest. We have Sister Marlene Shaw, down in the Nation of Islam days, and Sister Marlene 2X. She was a personal friend of Malcolm Shabazz, El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz is his proper name, commonly called Malcolm X. She spoke to him the day he called her the day he was assassinated. She's going to be on. And also we have our brother, Imam instructor, Benjamin Bilal, very close to our brother Khalil Islam in the New York area on a lot of fronts, a lot of activity. So those are going to be our guests coming on here shortly. But however, the show is titled Words Make People, and we know the best words for making people are the words of the Quran. So this is what we begin with. As Muslims, we should always begin our day, our activities with El Quran. This is what we live with. It's the word of Almighty God, Allah, given to us in El Quran. And when we say El Quran, we're going to say this too. That is the Quran in the Arabic, in the Arabia. And we are striving to get there. I know I got a long way to go. So we all in this together on various levels. The Quran in the English is good, but it's only a beginning. We have to get to the Quran in the Arabia. And I got, again, I'm not ashamed to say, I have a long way to go, but I look at how far I progress, and I'm very grateful for that, too. So we're going to read today from chapter 4 of the Quran, chapter 4, verse 58, Surah 4, or chapter 4, verse 58 of the Quran. And we, as you know, dear believers, and for those who don't know, first-time listeners, maybe they are a later listener, because these shows are archived. Everything being said today is being recorded and will be available as soon as the show goes off. Within 10 minutes of this show going off today, everything said today would be available. She has the link. You can use the link, share with a friend for next week, next month, maybe even next year, and hear this program again. So we say that, I would say explain what we say before reading the Quran, because we have no idea who and when they're going to hear this program. So the first thing a Muslim say before reading the Quran, we seek God's protection from Satan, the rejected enemy. So we say in Arabic, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. And that is, again, I seek refuge with Allah away from Satan, the rejected, accursed enemy. And then the next phrase we say before reading the Quran, unless it's chapter 9, we don't say this before chapter 9, but the other 113 chapters, we do say it first. Before reading, we say, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, with Allah's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. And with that, then we are ready to read. And I will read here, it says, Inna Allaha yakburukum an ta'udu. Ta'udul amenity. So Allah, the first point it says, in that, surely, or indeed, some say verily, Allah has ordered us. He has ordered us. It says, Yahmarukum. You hear the word Amr or Amir in that word. Allah has ordered us to render the trust. He says, render the trust or give the trust. The trust is El-Emetati. And you hear the word Iman. Or we say at the prayer, we say Amin. We can hear those words. They all go back to the same root as this word here. So Allah has ordered us. And Brother Imam and dear listeners, when Allah says he has ordered us, he's given us a command. Yeah, he's ordering us that we render the trust. He says to who? He says, illa ahliha, to the owners. There are people who deserve our trust, and it is the people. Allah, he is. This is an order from God to the rulers, to the parents, anybody in position, a friend to a friend. Allah has ordered all of humanity to render to the trust to the owners. And then Allah says, and when you judge, what is there hakam to? When you judge, judge where? It says, baina nasi. When you judge between the people. And keep in mind, dear believers, these are orders. This is an order from God. This is an order from God. When you judge between people, that you do it and tactical move, that you judge with build idol. What is this word idol? Idol is saying justice. Justice. That when you judge between people, God has given us an order that we judge with justice. And the surah concludes, Inna ilaha ni'ima ni'ima ya'itz lukum bihi. It says, indeed, Allah has given us excellent advice. Indeed, Allah has given us excellent advice. And the last part says, Inna Allah kana sabiyan basira. For surely indeed, Allah is all hearing, all seeing. So this verse here speaks to a very important aspect, Brother Imam. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this or chapter 4. Verse 58. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, please.
Yes, sir. Alhamdulillah. I like that you've chosen this particular ayat, this verse, to connect with our show for today, because these brothers that were exonerated and accused wrongfully and had to do time in prison, that was a very, 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 very unjust situation. And
yes, sir.
They're not the only people here in this country among the African American people and others, but mainly the African American people that have been unjustly sent to prison. But they didn't do it. They're innocent. And I know one brother, he told me he did 47 years and he didn't do it. But he wouldn't say anything about it, so they put him in prison. Also, the brother we just had the program with, the sister Zubeda's husband, they had him there, and he said for a fact if they would have had cameras, you know, back then he would be innocent today. So Allah commands this. I love what you said here. Inna Allah yamurukum and tawaddul wal amen. Amanati. God command. This is a command from God, you know? You know, I believe when Allah commands things, it's very serious. It's very serious, whether you're conscious of it or not. It's a very serious matter because it's a command from the Creator. That's powerful, man. A command from the Creator, you know. And the command is what? That you render back your trust. You know, give the trust back to the people. You know, give the trust back. Be, you know, uphold the trust. Uphold the trust. You know, this is so important because, you know, every one of us have been born with this in us, this trust. Allah put trust in every human being. And you're supposed to trust other people. And you do trust them until they do something to show you that you have to, you know, be careful of them, be cautious of them, because you can't trust them in this area. But that trust is something that human beings are born with. So, you know, you have to render back your trust to those to whom they are due. So if the trust is due someone, you should trust them. You shouldn't, and everyone's due trust. Everyone is due trust in the beginning, in the original stages. Everybody is due trust. You got to trust every human being that has been created by Almighty God. So all of us deserve that, okay? And then when you judge now here's where the problem comes in a lot. Because people, they start judging, okay? And they judge you as though they mistrust. They judge you as though they mistrust you, you know. Well, we don't trust you. You know, look how long that has went on in this country with us. You know, we were just mistrusted because we were who we were. You know, we wasn't trusted. You know that old saying, I'm broke, disgusted, and can't be trusted.
Right.
Disgusted and can't be trusted. Well, that's us, man. You know, we was broke, we was disgusted, and no one trust us, you know. This is a beautiful example of how when you judge between people and you make a decision and you come to a conclusion and you're logical about them, be just, you know. Hikmatun baina nas, you know, when you judge between people and taqumul bil adl, you know, be just when you judge, be just, you know, and Allah, you know, Allah tells us to be just, even though it be rich or poor, you know. Be just,
right,
even if it be against yourself. Yeah, mother, father, you know, even if be against yourself. We're a near relative involved, you know. And so and don't let your heart swerve from justice just because you hate somebody or hate something. Still, you have to be fair toward them and just toward them. I mean, these are things that should really be implemented in our society even more. I mean, and these people are familiar with the Quran. They've read the Quran and they know that's the truth. But still, we have a justice system that really is unjust. It's an unjust justice system that needs to be corrected, okay? So verily, how excellent, God says, how excellent, inna laha ni'ima from na'im, how excellent is the teaching. You see, ya'idukum bihi, ya'idukum from wa'ala, the teaching, you see, the pronouncement, you know, the exhortation of this particular teaching right here. How excellent it is, you know, which God giveth you. Inna laha kana sami'an basiran. And God is the all-hearing and the all-knowing. So if you don't get this, human being, if you don't get this, don't worry. God hears everything and Allah sees everything. And on the final day of judgment, when everyone has to stand before their Creator, you will be held accountable. We're not applying this particular principle here. That's what I get out of this.
Sir.
This is beautiful. This is wonderful.
Yes.
Alhamdulillah.
It is. It's so rich. I mean, it is so rich. I'm going to get into our topic here now, but
we have
to understand, and Muslims, remember this here about the Quran. We know this. Just a reminder. When it comes to the Quran, there are three C's in the English you can use. The Quran is a confirmation of the books that came before, not just for Muslims, but for humanity, a confirmation. The second C, it is a correction. It is correcting the errors that man put into revelation. They put into, they mixed it in with revelation. So the Quran comes to correct all of those errors made. The third C is that it is for the conclusion of revelation. So when we read this verse, right now we're just on this verse, what is this verse confirming? What is it correcting? And what is it concluding? Ask that question on every verse of the Quran, every word of the Quran that we read. Ask those three C's. Ask those three C's. Because a lot of things that what Prophet Muhammad brought, we take them for granted today because they're so common today. But what the Prophet brought to humanity was the conclusion of things, like public education. This here, public justice, and the justice that the world we take for granted today in quote-unquote democratic societies, it got its conclusion, its best presentation with the Quran and the life model of Prophet Muhammad. So, alhamdulillah, we can go on. But let's get into our topic. Our topic today is to talk about two Muslims. And you can add in their family, because when a person goes to prison, as we know, the whole family goes to prison, mentally and spiritually, financially, etc. But we're keying in on our two brothers today, mainly Khalil Islam, formerly known as Thomas 15X. Falsely accused of killing our brother, Elhaj Malik al-Shabazz. As we said, he's commonly known as Malcolm X. So sadly, when Malcolm was assassinated, so was the name and the character of two innocent men assassinated by our government. That's on the city level and the federal level. Officials who knowingly falsely accused Muhammad Aziz, at the time known as Norman 3X Butler, and Khalil Islam, at the time known as Thomas 15X Johnson. They knowingly and falsely accused these two brothers of murder. They knew at the time. Government officials knew at that time. They did not do it. Here it is, 58 years, 8 months, 28 days. This past November 18th, our brothers Muhammad Aziz and Khalil Islam were exonerated of all charges associated with the tragedy of that day, February 21st, 1965. So join us today here on Words Made People for a thorough conversation from people who personally knew, in particular, Brother Khalil Islam. They knew him before he was incarcerated, and they knew him for years, decades after he was released. I think he served 22 years, I believe. We don't have a lot of contact, per se, unless someone called in who we can verify. If we can't verify, you're not going to take your information. If you can verify that you know Muhammad Aziz, and it can be confirmed, then we will take your words. But the two who I have come along, we have confirmation, they knew Brother Khalil Islam. So, Jonathan, in this conversation, we're going to get into the conversation. We want to hear from you, our listeners, as well. After we hear from our guests, we can press one on your phone. We can bring you into the conversation. So, once again, we want to have a thorough conversation from people who personally knew these brothers. The show is being recorded. It will be archived and available to be shared. So alhamdulillah, we read from the Quran, we say, Sadakallah wa'azim. It's got to say that Allah has spoken the mighty truth. So at this point here, we're going to bring on our beloved brother, instructor, Imam. I'm going to say Imam first. Imam, instructor, Benjamin Bilal, currently in I think he's in North Carolina, maybe in South Carolina. Many years in New York City, well-known, highly respected brother. Brother Imam, instructor, Benjamin Belair, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum assalam to my dear brother and this dear audience. Can you hear me clearly?
We can hear you loud and clear. Yes, sir.
Excellent. So we pray that the peace be upon each and every listening member of this program. Thank you for the invitation.
We can hear you.
Yes, sir. And thank you for being here with us. I was hoping that our sister Marlene had called in first because I wanted her to speak on what she knew. But whenever she calls in, we will bring her in. Let me look down my board. Maybe she's her number's at the bottom of the screen. She didn't. If she thought she should press 1, so we can bring her into the conversation. And no, I do not see her number yet. But she said she's going to call in, so we just wait for her to call in. But while we have you here, Brother Imam, you know, I think about this quote I heard from my brother, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, Malcolm X. He made a comment one time. He said, so a man takes a knife and sticks it in your back, 6 inches. Then later on, he caught himself being just to you, so he pulled it out 3 inches. And he wants you to tell him thank you. This is what I see here in this situation here with our two brothers, Muhammad Aziz, Khalil Islam. They never should have had been accused, let alone put on trial, and for surely doing 20 years and 22 years in prison. And so that quote from Malcolm X came to my mind. You're going to put a knife in my back 6 inches, and then one day you're going to pull it out 3 and want me to tell you thank you? Like hell. Excuse my expression, like hell. And so here these brothers here are being exonerated for something they never should have been charged with. But I'm going to let you pick up, Brother Imam Bilal, from wherever you want to pick up, because you have an association. Yeah, let's begin there. Let us update the listeners as to how you know Khalil Islam. So later on, as you speak, they'll know that you are speaking from firsthand experience. Can you do that for us, please?
Absolutely. And I think just in the interest of giving more fortification to your quote from Minister Malcolm X, Malcolm Shabazz, he said that if you stick it in 6 inches and pull it out 3 inches, he said that's not progress. He said even if you pull the knife all of the way out, he said that's still not progress. He said progress is addressing the wound that was caused from the injury in the first place. So that's pretty much where we are, you know, as far as what some people are feeling about the exoneration. They feel as though maybe the knife has been pulled out all 6 inches, but the wound is still bleeding, and that needs to be addressed because many people have been hurt over and above the two individuals whom we're here to discuss today. But let me say that I first met Khalil in 1989, keeping in mind that he was released from prison after 22 years, as you said. He was released in 1987, and I met him at an event in New York that was attended by several notable people, Imam Ali Rashid, who was the imam at Malcolm Shabazz Masjid at that time, Yusuf Shaw, who was also an imam, who now has a masjid named after him, Masjid Yusuf Shaw, in Yonkers, New York. And there were several other notables, but for some reason, my eyes kept turning towards this light complexion, bald-headed man who just seemed to stand out. I didn't know who he was, although I had heard about him, read about him. And it was after that event that I was asked to come over to the car that he was entering. And I was then introduced to him as Khalil Islam, the former Thomas 15X Johnson, who did 22 years for a crime that he absolutely, positively did not commit. And that was the beginning of my relationship with him. I then met him at another event where he was the main speaker, and I think I was handling the sound for that particular program. And we locked eyes again, and we began to talk, and we exchanged numbers, and he became one of my best friends from that point on, all of the way up until his passing in 2009. So there's a lot of in-between relationship that, you know, we can discuss any aspect of my personal relationship with Khalil. Just to speak on his personal persona, he was a very gentle man, believe it or not. He could be gruff, because remember now, he was a part of the Nation of Islam's contingency of what are called enforcers. And we can talk about that if you choose to get into that. But there were certain people who were in positions in the Nation of Islam who had certain roles to play. And his role was as an FBI. He was a lieutenant in the New York contingency of the Fruit of Islam. And they were asked to do certain tasks. And the major task that the FOI were to engage in is whenever the Honorable Elijah Muhammad would come to town, these are the people who would be his private bodyguards and such. So that was Khalil. He was very well known in the Harlem, New York area, although he wasn't born in Harlem. He was born in Pricedale, Pennsylvania, the capital of which is Harrisburg. And he lived in Pennsylvania only for about 6 years. His father at the time had a very serious accident. He was working in the coal mines, and you know what kind of dangerous situations that could lead to. So at 6 years old, his father decided to move them out of that one-horse town of Pricedale into New York City, Bronx, New York. So from 6 years old and further, he grew up in the Bronx pretty much and became very, very interested in the nightlife that New York had to offer at that time. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about the time when Sarah Vaughan and Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington, you know, the big swing era, the big band. That's the period that we're talking now. So Khalil became the go-to person for some undesirable events that were notable among the musicians. They were people who liked to sniff coke and, you know, do these other things, drink their liquors and all that. So before Khalil knew anything about the Nation of Islam, this was the kind of life he was leading. And he was very well liked and very well known by your Billie Holidays and your Sarah Vaughans and your, you know, your other people who were major players in the area of African American entertainment at the time. And well, you know, one thing led to another, and he was introduced to the language of the Nation of Islam, not so much through Malcolm, who was the minister at the time, but through an assistant minister who he got to know. And he began to regularly visit what was called at the time Temple Number 7 on 116th Street and Lenox Avenue. And one thing led to another, and Minister Malcolm, you know, as you know, he was traveling a lot. So you don't really get a chance to know him or even meet him just because you went to the temple one Sunday or one Friday. You got to know him by going consistently, and that's what Thomas at the time, as he was called, was doing. And he eventually met Malcolm and became one of the top lieutenants under the ministry of Malcolm X, as he was called at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting, you know, because everyone have a journey, and sometimes it's good to know that person's journey. So what year did he come into the Nation of Islam, the Brother Khalil Islam, or Thomas at the time? What year did he come in, or nearby did he join the Nation?
Yeah. I'm not remembering the exact year. I'm willing to guess, though, that it was either the late 50s or the early 60s. But that's just an educated guess. I'm not sure. I do know that he told me on several occasions that he didn't go through the regular protocol that a person would go through once entering the Nation. You had to go through several years of this, training of that, and knowing of this, and memorizing of that. But his brain was so keen at the time that he was able to just shoot through that like it was nothing. So he rose in the ranks very, very quickly and became lieutenant in the Nation of Islam in New York City. And Thomas 15X Johnson, for people who don't know what the X's are about, it only means that he was the 15th Thomas coming into that particular temple. So the way that they would keep record or keep track of the people and who they actually were, if there was another Thomas, they needed to know which Thomas was which. So he became the 15th Thomas, and therefore Thomas 15X Johnson. Just as Malcolm was Malcolm X only, it's only because Malcolm was the first Malcolm in that temple, in wherever he came in at. I believe it was New York City.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you. Yes, you know, and those are small points that are very good points to bring out. Yes, sir. Because people ask all the time, you know, why these numbers? And you just gave the reason why. So, good, good. Did he speak any about, you know, we keying in again just for the listening audience to know, Brother Khalil Islam, his former name was Thomas Johnson. So when we say Khalil Islam, we talk about the same person as Thomas 15X Johnson. So I would ask, did he share any of his thoughts about the time he served in? The injustice of his sentence.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the first conversations that we had. And he said something very unusual, and it stuck with me ever since. Again, yes, we are speaking about the same person when we say Thomas Johnson and Khalil Islam. In fact, Khalil, out of the three men who were sentenced, was the only one who Imam Waris-ud-Din Muhammad gave a name to. So Imam Muhammad actually visited Thomas while he was in prison. And he said that the first thing that Imam Muhammad asked him, he said he looked him square in his eyes and he asked him, did you kill Malcolm X? And he looked in his eyes and Khalil said, no, sir, looking straight back into his eyes. And Imam Muhammad said, woof. He said, you've just relieved me of a tremendous burden. He said, I was hoping you would say no. So Imam Muhammad, in that same visit, he conferred upon him the name Khalil, which means intimate friend, and Islam. Mm. So Imam Muhammad named him the intimate friend of Islam. And I believe it's because of the work that Khalil was putting in terms of the institutions, both he and Norman Butler, who's also now known as Abdel Aziz, so Muhammad Abdel Aziz. He's the other innocent party who was just exonerated. Both of them were putting in some serious ministerial and imam work. Once Imam Muhammad came in, they stopped being ministers in the Nation of Islam, and they became imams in the world community of al-Islam, as Imam Muhammad named it. So both of them were putting in work, and people were coming into Islam by the droves. Under those two particular people, they are almost... And also another brother who you're familiar with, Rasul, Big Rasul, they used to call him. He just recently passed a few years ago. These people were putting in work. They were putting in so much work, Mikhail, that they had to keep switching them from institution to institution to institution because they were becoming too popular. But everywhere they would switch them to, that particular place would become full of
Muslims. That's right.
That idea. There was no... Sufi, there was no all of these other schools of thought that we have now, Hanbali and Wahhabi and all of that we're seeing in today's prison institutions. They were null and void back then. Very few Muslims from the international world or from other schools of thought, even if they were African American, they were not in these prisons. The majority of Muslims in the 70s and the 80s especially were Muslims under the leadership of Imam W.D. Muhammad. First under Elijah Muhammad in the 50s and the 60s. And as you know, Elijah Muhammad himself went to prison. W.D. Muhammad himself went to prison for not conforming to the draft regulations that he go to war. And his father encouraged him to not do so. he would have gone, but mm-hmm. his father encouraged him not to do so, and therefore he did a few years also. That's basically what happened in terms of Khalil. So we are talking about the same person.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
But his answer, just to get back to your initial question, or the answer to your question, is that I asked him how he felt about doing 22 straight years. Now, keep in mind that this is a man who went in with a life sentence. That life sentence just happened to be commuted in 1987. And that's only Allah who could do that level of miracle. However, when he first went in, I believe he did 5 straight years in what they call the box. The box is solitary confinement. So obviously they did not, or someone did not want this man talking to anybody when he first got in. And when we say the box, we're literally talking about putting you in a box with no light, just a little window so you can receive some food and some sunlight from time to time. But he was literally, if you can imagine what it would take, what kind of tenacity in your soul you'd have to do 5 years without losing your mind in the box. And then thereafter, they let him out into population. So when I asked him, Khalil, you have to feel a certain kind of way. He said, then believe it or not, he said, I'm not bitter at all. He said, in fact, when they sentenced me, he said, I knew they were going to sentence me. He said, because of the way the court case itself was going or not going. He said, but I'm going to go in the front door. This is what he told the court. I'm going in the front door and I'm coming out the back door. But he told me, he said, the reason I'm not bitter is not because I did it. He said, I know I didn't do it. And all of those people, the judges, the police department, the CIA, whoever was, spying on the organization, they knew that he didn't do it. They knew he wasn't there. He couldn't have been there. They would have known this man. He was a top lieutenant in New York. They would have known him as soon as he came down the block, much less entered the Autobahn. So he said, the reason why I'm not bitter is because he understands the law of reciprocity. And he said, it's not that other things didn't happen in the Nation of Islam or in his life, just growing up, being a street man, being a hustler, being a this, being a that. Other things happen. And sometimes Allah allows you mm-hmm. to work that off in this life so that you don't have to deal with it in the next. So that was his position, and that's how he told it to me. So because of that, you didn't see any kind of prison stain on this man's face. None. You would have to have asked him, was he in prison? Sometimes you can look at the person who's done that kind of time and immediately tell, hey, man, this dude's been to jail. But Khalil wasn't that kind of face. He was just such a meek but very, very deep and knowledgeable individual. I'm talking about in terms of the dean. He was in he was a scholar of the Bible. Remember now, Elijah Muhammad's emphasis was on the Bible, not on the Quran. So most of his studies were in the Bible. He knew the Quran very well also, but that was an aftermath type of research. His main research was the Bible. And if I'm remembering correctly, he may have gotten degrees in biblical research while he was in prison, while he was incarcerated. I don't remember exactly. But the man could run rings around the average Christian preacher. I knew that. Because he did that on many occasions while in prison and outside of prison. But he was a very meek person. I didn't know the wife whom he was married to at the time he was arrested, but I do know the exact details of how they came to get him and how he came to be arrested. There were other issues surrounding that arrest. And I didn't know that wife, but after he got out of prison, he remarried a woman named Helen. And they actually got married a second time, and I was blessed to be the officiator of that ceremony.
Yes,
so Khalil and I, once again, we go back. Mm-hmm.
Yes, hopefully when Sister Marlene come on, she can fill in that, because what Sister Marlene just told me, she's been on my show twice before and shared this already, that his wife at the time was a sister named Etta, E-T-T-A, Etta. And it was Sister Marlene here said, and again, you can go through the archives and you can find it. she said, on the day that Malcolm was assassinated, that Malcolm called her, I guess, on his way getting ready to go to the Audubon. He called her that day and was telling her, you know, to look out for Betty and look out for the children, because Sister Marlene and Sister Betty were quite close. And that she said Thomas or Khalil Islam at her home, painting her apartment when Malcolm was assassinated. And so when she comes on, if she comes on, she can say it better, because I want you to get the first-hand information, getting for me the second-hand information. But she said that Thomas was a excellent painter. She said, if you did film at your place when you got back, the painting was so precise, so good, until you wouldn't even know you were in your own place. She said that's how good of a painter he was. So when she got word that Malcolm had been assassinated, she called Thomas and said, Thomas, go home to your family. The minister's been assassinated. And so I asked her, you said the obvious question, well, if you know that now, did you tell that to the police then? She said, brother, they did. Yes, she said, we told them that they didn't want to hear it. So they wouldn't even take that in as evidence. So he got here, a first-hand witness, that said he was not at the Audubon. He was painting my house.
Yes.
You know, so
I corroborate that. By his direct statements to me. That can be corroborated. And to keep in mind also that it's not as though Malcolm was assassinated and then they immediately figured out who done it and they came to get the people who did it. Khalil wasn't visited by the police department until 3 days later. So keep that in mind. And when they came to get him, he was actually suffering in one of his hands with acute arthritis. In his what would be his trigger hand, he had acute arthritis, and he also had, I think, thrombitis in his legs, which made it very difficult to walk up steps. And they're saying that the people who did the shooting ran up the steps, especially after the shooting was done. They ran down the steps and got away. And so evidently, and they described the shotgun man as being big, brawly, with a long black beard and dark-skinned, which is the exact, you know, opposite of Khalil's look, you know, his description. So, again, the police department understood this, and I'm thankful to our brother Abdul Rahman Muhammad, who put out the Netflix documentary called Who Killed Malcolm X, because he made these things very, very vivid in terms of the contrast between who they say did it in the reports that they have at the police department and the description of the people who they actually arrested in the form of Khalil and Abdelaziz.
Yes,
they nowhere fit the description.
Yes. So what other kind of evidence that you know of that just came out over the years to let us...
Well,
we already know.
Yeah, the most glaring evidence is the testimony of Talmadge Hayer himself. That would be Mujahid Halim, he's called now, Mujahid, whom I've had the opportunity to meet also and speak to very briefly. I was trying to get him to do a full-fledged interview, which he refused to do. He was...
Let me ask you, I'm sorry, before you go further, tell this audience who he is and his role in this whole situation.
Yes, sir. Yeah. He's the one known as Talmadge Hayer, or sometimes spelled Hagen, who was the actual trigger man, or one of several trigger men at the Audubon that evening. And midway through the court case, he admitted, because he was being backed against the wall in terms of the evidence. So he began the court case saying that he did not do it. He didn't know who these people were. They were showing him pictures of himself in the Newark Mosque, and he said, that's not me, you know, that kind of thing. So by the time he figured that they were going to catch up with him, he then said, okay, I did do it, and I'm not going to tell you how and under what circumstances I did what I did, but I will say to you that these other two men, he said, I don't even know them. They were not a part of it. But the courts were able to swing it so that it sounded as though, well, I'm caught, but I'm going to make sure my brothers get away, you know. So, and the other thing was that they would not allow Khalil and Abdelaziz to have their own separate attorney. They had to be tried together. So whatever happened to one was going to happen to the other.
Mm.
And they had court-appointed attorneys. They didn't have actual lawyers. And the reason they had court-appointed attorneys was not because the Nation of Islam, which had plenty of money at that time, 1960-65, it's not that they could not, it's not that they could not have paid for a top-notch lawyer. It's that they thought the case was going to be open and shut because everybody knew that they were not there. So why spend all of this money on lawyers when they're just going to walk in and walk out and everything is going to be rolled? But it didn't turn out like that. They manipulated that evidence so keenly. And as the sister is going to tell you, if she's with us, that there were many witnesses, plenty of witnesses who knew both these men and who knew the setup in the Nation of Islam. They knew the New York Temple and all of its ramifications. And the police department didn't call any of them. They all volunteered themselves as witnesses, and the police department refused to call them, including some of Malcolm's closest compadres who were with Malcolm and said, I know Thomas Johnson and Norman, they were not there. They couldn't possibly have been there. Even Mike Wallace, the same newscaster, after speaking to Khalil, he said, Mr. Johnson, I'm quoting, Mr. Johnson could not possibly have been present on that fateful day.
Wow. You know, so that's glaring evidence, but they still serve 20 years for Muhammad Aziz and 22 years for Khalil Islam. I want to interject something here. I have the actual autobiography of Malcolm X as given to us by Edgar Haley. I'm on page 438 of this book. And Malcolm was talking to, this is in the epilogue of the book, and it reads, he says, he, referring to Malcolm, he digressed on the dangers he faced. You know, I'm going to tell you something, brother. Now, he's talking to Edith Haley. Malcolm says, but, you know, I'm going to tell you something, brother. The more I keep thinking about this thing, the things that have been happening lately, I'm not all that sure it's the Muslims. I know what they can do and what they can't do and what they can't. And they can do some of the stuff recently going on. Now, I'm going to tell you, the more I keep thinking about what happened to me in France, I think I'm going to quit saying it's the Muslims. This here was about 2 days before Malcolm was, and this is also overlooked quite a bit as well, that Malcolm said these words, because at another point he says, what happened to him being poisoned in Egypt and him being denied entry into France. He knew that was too big for the Nation of Islam. So Malcolm even himself was recognizing, even though there were some difficulties, we're not playing that down. There were some serious difficulties. But we also take into consideration the words of our Malcolm, of our brother Malcolm, Mr. Malcolm Shabazz as well. We do have a couple of callers here. But I'd like to get your comments. But Ayman, please, you can ask anything you want to as well.
I'm listening. May I give a comment to what you just read?
please.
Okay. And I'll try to make this fast. We're
not going to do anything fast because we want information. Take your time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Malcolm was a man of mixed emotions, and this is my personal opinion in reading his story, also in interviewing at least one of his family members, one of his daughters. And not to mistake what I'm saying with what she said, but this is just the feeling that I walked away with after interviewing her about whatever she could tell me of her father, who, as you know, she was a baby practically. I'm not even sure she was one of the ones who wasn't born at the time, but I know that he had, she was pregnant at the time.
Two twins,
yes, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. She was pregnant with the twins, yes.
Right, okay. So this particular daughter was very, very young, so she didn't really know him in a way to give us precisely detailed information, but I say he was torn emotionally because Malcolm, towards those last few weeks of his life, began to make different statements as the one that you just mentioned that he gave to Mr. Alex Haley in saying that I'm starting to doubt that it was the Nation of Islam because this was beyond their reach, and that's correct. But keep in mind also that the FBI and the CIA both had informants in the Nation of Islam. So every brother ain't a brother. When you're looking at the person next to you in the FOI, it doesn't mean that he came there of his own volition. Many of them were hired agents. So to say completely that the quote-unquote Nation of Islam had nothing to do with it might not be the whole truth and nothing but the truth. They may have something to do with it in the fact that agents that do operate outside of the continental United States were also implanted within the Nation of Islam. So it could very well have been that people in the nation, quote unquote, although agents, were in cooperation with other people outside of the nation in France and in these other countries that Malcolm visited, even as far as Egypt, when he went to Egypt and when he went to Saudi for his Hajj or his Umrah.
Mm-hmm.
So these are situations where Malcolm began to not put as much emphasis on the nation. Now, keep in mind, it was something else that was a tremendous influence in terms of Malcolm's changing of his decision, and that was that he, for whatever reason, saw at some point that he was going to be, in his mind, better off back with Elijah Muhammad than not with Elijah Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
So he began to write Elijah Muhammad letters almost begging him to come back into the nation and he'll do what he's told and so forth and so on and, you know, and that kind of thing. But these letters were also being usurped by the government, and many of them Elijah Muhammad never got, or when he did get it, they had been reconfigured as threats against Elijah Muhammad. So Elijah Muhammad is thinking that Malcolm is threatening his life, and Malcolm is wondering why he's not getting a response from the man that he's pouring his heart out to in terms of wanting to come back. So when you look at that level of secret government involvement in what was going on, then you can understand the tremendous amount of influence that J. Edgar Hoover at the time, head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, as well as the CIA and other forces, you know, what they were doing to actually aid this permanent split and hope that one group would go against the other. And when they went against Malcolm to begin with, the government said good riddance.
Well, I think it was more than a hope, because there had been reports that government officials made up fake letters, said it was from Malcolm, it wasn't from Malcolm, and sent it to Elijah. And did it the flip. They made up fake letters, said it was from Elijah, and sent them to Malcolm, to make sure that the two never got back together again. So they really went above and beyond. And if anybody knows, this is not a topic today, but just do like any kind of study on COINTELPRO, which is the counterintelligence program. It was so corrupt until I think Congress in 1970s, in the 1970s, Congress came out and condemned that COINTELPRO operation because one of their main goals was to make sure that a quote-unquote black messiah did not rise to unite African-American people. And they had Dr. Yes. King on the list, they had Malcolm X on the list, and others on the list to where that happened. This is not to criticize, this is just to tell the truth. And we said from the beginning, reading from the Quran, we're going to speak for justice. We're going to speak for what is right. We got two brothers who have all this time in prison, and they never should have. Now, you have really gave us insight, had no idea. This brother was really crucified. That's my word. Crucified to spend 5 years in the hole. The first 5 years in the hole, they were trying to take him out all the way, to break him all the way. You
indeed.
Don't do that unless you're trying to break somebody.
Yeah,
yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And also keep in mind that we had an interview. I brought Khalil to an interview with Imam Muhammad at some point in New Jersey. I forget which city. But after Imam spoke, we had a private meeting. Not a private, we had a news reporter there, I think, from NBC also, who had a chance to listen to Khalil and Imam Muhammad have an exchange, a conversation. And that's when that whole story was told about when Imam Muhammad went to visit him the first time and why he asked him, you know, did you do it? And he was relieved to know that he did not. But I'm sorry, there was another point I was getting ready to make and it got away from me. But nevertheless, the point, I know what it was, yeah, alhamdulillah. W.D. Muhammad was also put out of the Nation of Islam at least three times while he was mm-hmm. under his father's administration. And the second time, at the same time that Malcolm was put out of the nation. People say that Malcolm mm-hmm. left the Nation of Islam, but that's not true. Malcolm was put out of the Nation of Islam, which was common practice amongst the Nation of Islam when a member would do something that they were not asked to do or do something differently than what they were asked to do. They would be given mm-hmm. a certain number of days depending on the class violation. And Malcolm, I believe, was given 90 days. And as far as the nation was concerned, he didn't conform to the rules of not cohorting with other members of the Nation of Islam. He could come to the mm-hmm. temple, but he couldn't speak and that kind of thing. And he was not to visit the homes of other people who were in the nation, and Malcolm did all of the above. He did all of the above.
Yes,
but
so
did Imam Muhammad when he was put out. Imam Muhammad was told, don't come see your mother, don't come see your father. And he said to himself, well, who are they to tell me I can't come see my mother, you know, that kind of thing. So, and he would go back to the restaurant. He was an employee of the local restaurant in Chicago, Imam Muhammad. He was like a chef. So he went there to pick up his check, and, you know, and they would look at him with those cross eyes also, like, what are you doing here, brother? Don't you know who we are?
Yes,
and they said, don't you know what we can do to you? He said, yeah. He said, no. He said, you can't do nothing to me unless Allah will. And he pushed right past some of the big goons at that time. So
let me get my phone call there. Let me just end by saying
that both of them were in the same predicament. And Malcolm at the time, alongside trying to get back in the nation through these letters to Elijah Muhammad, which were not being received by him, Malcolm was also petitioning W.D. to form a separate organization or to take control over his Muslim Mosque Incorporated. He wanted Wallace to be the head of that, and Wallace refused.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, that's right. So let me get our calls in. We are on the topic of Brother Khalil Islam, and also along with him was Muhammad Aziz being exonerated. You know, we're going to ask our callers to ask a question, make a short comment, but we don't need long comments. We have our guests on our show for that because we want to cover as much material as possible. So we go to our first caller here from 773. Caller from 773-450. We're on Words Make People. Thanks for calling in. Can you give us your first name and your city, please?
Assalamu alaikum. This is Bashir Saad, Chicago, Illinois. That's why I'm able to call our distinguished guests here and the topic we have today. And we're definitely grateful for our brothers to be released, showing that they weren't convicted. As I said, the long arc of justice is always bending to the right. But this is, I know you said you don't want long comments, and I got a long comment.
Brother Bashir, I take my hat off to you. I'm going to make an exception because you've been around for a minute. As the young folks say, you've been around for a minute. So
okay. Thank you. Yeah. Because this is a real involved situation. It's not a simple, situation that we're talking about. Imam quite often said, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was very serious about his Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam was a very serious movement. And our movement today is still serious. And in the exoneration of the conviction of our two brothers, I think it also points to the exoneration of the conviction of the Nation of Islam. Because the Nation of Islam was convicted of this assassination of our brother, Malcolm. And as our brother Bilal pointed out, this was a conspiratorial move on the government to convict these brothers and their association with the Nation of Islam. And we know about the co-protailer. So all, the imam pointed out, said, we're living in the real world and we have to deal with this situation in its reality. And so this is a very involved topic that we're talking about. There's many aspects to this situation. And I've been looking at it like I look at many things. And what you had just pointed out too, this whole situation that evolved has to be looked at. And what was, how it developed, what were the justifications in it, what were the errors? There were some errors in it. But it's a long, it's a broad situation that needs to be entailed. The fact of how the situation happened, with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad instructing his ministers not to say anything derogatory about President Kennedy. And this was a wise move on this leadership. And it has to be a point of discussion and a point of judgment. And then with Malcolm's speaking out like he did, and then the Honorable Elijah Muhammad putting those injunctions on him, whether this was right, whether this was correct, whether or not Malcolm, in his reaction to it, did the right thing and the correct thing. Because even the things that he came and pointed out after that situation happened and pointed out some errors that he felt the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had made, understand, too, the Imam Wardi Muhammad knew about those same things. And I think we could take from the responses of the two men, what was the responsible action? I know our brother Bilal talked about how Malcolm, the emotionality that he observed during that period of time. When I watched the documentary, Who Killed Malcolm X, and in one part of the documentary, there was a newsman that asked Malcolm, or Malcolm made a response and said that he thought the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was an old, feeble-minded man. And I came into the community in 1968 after this had happened. I had some personal contact with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, not extensive. But over that period of time, I never seen from the period of time from 68 to the time he died, I never seen an old, feeble-minded man. So when I seen this in the documentary, I said, wow, I think he was acting out of emotionality. I'm gonna cut this short. Yeah, I understand. I need to cut it short. But I wanna say one other thing too, that in our language too. I know we mentioned about these brothers being enforcers. Now I don't think that's the proper language to use. We were soldiers. These men in FYI were soldiers. We had men like Khalid bin Walid. We had men like Omar. We had men like Abu Bakr. But you know, there had been a negative connotation that the Nation of Islam, they enforced, made people buy and sell newspapers, forced into donations. No, so maybe some little aspect, but most of us were doing it out of strong faith and conviction to this movement.
Yes, sir.
So I'll cut it short.
Great
there. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. Imam Lal, you have any comments on what Brother Assad?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And thank you, Bashir, for your comments. What I want to say is, first of all, I want to repeat the old adage that you're to never judge a man until you walk the mile in his moccasins. So one of the things I'm trying desperately to not do in this interview is to place any kind of moral judgment or any kind of stamp of approval or disapproval on anybody. That includes the men who were arrested. That includes the man who actually pulled the trigger. And that includes, of course, Minister Malcolm, or as we know him today, Malik Shabazz. I don't want to say right, wrong, Elijah said, Malcolm said, the minister said, and then start getting into the semantics of the language. When I use the term enforcer, I know what I'm talking about. I'm a man who studied language for a living. And I'm telling you exactly the language that Khalil Islam used about what they were doing in the streets. They knew themselves to be enforcers by that word. Now, we can look at it, feel any way about it we want to feel in 2021, but in 1962, 63, 64, 65, those men, a certain contingency, not the entire FOI. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a group of highly trained martial artists whose job was to enforce the rules and regulations of the nation, not on people outside of the Nation of Islam necessarily, but on people who they felt were becoming rogue members, or members who didn't pay their dues, or members who didn't sell the papers, or members or whatever. And I could bring them to you if we had a trial. I'd bring them to you 10 at a time every day for at least the next few weeks.
Well, let me say this here.
So I'm not here to say the Nation of Islam were bad guys. I'm here to say that there's always a small group of people within the larger group of very good people who sometimes we would call the right thing.
Let me reel this in. We're going to get back to our topic. And I think both of you are doing very well in explaining your thoughts, but this is getting away from our focus. Our focus is on our two brothers being exonerated, and we're going to keep it right there, right there. So we thank you. We'll move on to our next caller. Our next caller here from, they went away. Okay, we got a caller here. No, here, I think it came back. Caller from 770. Thanks for calling Works for Many People. Can you give us your first name, your question, and your brief comment, please?
My first name is Marlene.
Oh, Sister Marlene.
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you. You call from a different number. Okay.
Well, no, the 770 number that I gave you. But anyway, I think I spoke with you, and I just wanted to make a fact about and straighten out this thing about, who assassinated Malcolm and so forth and so on.
Sister Marlene.
Like I said to you.
Sister Marlene.
Yes.
Yeah, no. Let's do this here, because you are my special guest along with Imam Benjamin Bilal. All right, so don't lose your thought, but I want you to fill in some gaps that I tried to fill in earlier. Take us back to the, now don't lose your thought now, but take us back. So you knew Malcolm. You spoke to him the day he was assassinated. So for the benefit of our listening audience, can you review that, please? Can you go over that, please?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, ma'am. If you can go back and tell us about the day that Malcolm was assassinated, and he called you that day.
Hello?
Yes. Yeah, we can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, this is Sister Marlene. I can hear you.
Yes, we can hear you too. So go ahead. Yeah, can you tell us about the day? Well, this is the day Malcolm was assassinated, and he called
you that
morning.
The day Malcolm was assassinated, the two brothers that they say assassinated him were not true, because those two brothers were painting my house, Thomas Johnson and the other brother. They were painting. So they had nothing to do. And in fact, when I heard it on the radio that Malcolm was assassinated, I told him, stop painting, go home to your wife, because Malcolm was just assassinated. Those brothers were in my house. So they had nothing to do with assassinating Malcolm.
Yes, ma'am. So, and this is so that you knew these brothers as well.
Yes, I knew Thomas and Norman, because Thomas was a great painter. You know, he could make your house look like it was brand new when he finished, and also Norman. And like I said, when I heard it over the radio and on TV, I went and told him, put down the paintbrush, go home to your wife, because Malcolm was just assassinated. They were painting my house.
Yes, ma'am.
So they had
absolutely
nothing to do with they certainly couldn't be in my house and assassinate Malcolm at the same time.
That's right. And when you carried that evidence to the police, what happened?
I called them and told them, but, you know, nobody wanted to do anything about it. So they were supposed to check into it and get back to me, and nobody did. And this group up in Albany, where I used to be with all the time, I told them about it. And they're still going through the whole thing, because I told them about this years ago, and I was just talking to them the other day. And the gentleman said, you know, Marlene, I remember you telling me that, you know, they were in your house.
Yes.
Now, so they're also just trying to, has to do with money and whatever. I guess that's supposed to be at some point given to his kids or grandkids, but they were not, those brothers had nothing to do with it.
Yes, ma'am. So you said
they
Malcolm called
they couldn't
you.
Be painting my house and down there assassinating Malcolm at the same time.
That's right. Amen.
So I brought this to the attention of several people, but nobody seemed to want to, you know, they were just out to say that Malcolm did this, you know, that they did the assassination. He had nothing. Because I spoke with Malcolm earlier that particular day, and he had said to me, Sister Marlene, I'm going to be a...
Hello?
Yeah.
No, your phone went out. You said, what did Malcolm say to you the day he died?
Well, we were talking, and he said he didn't know he was going to be assassinated that day, but he said, Sister Marlene, I'm going to be assassinated. And he said, what I would like for you to do is watch out for Betty, which was his wife and his kids. And I said, I certainly will.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, and what you're saying is key information. Email Myman or email Blair. You have anything you want to ask, Sister Marlene?
Pardon me.
Now, we have the other two brothers on. My co-host, Imam Ayman from L.A., so my brother, Imam Benjamin Bilal from, I would say, New York. I think he's in North Carolina now. I was asking them if they had anything that they wanted to ask her.
No. I just appreciate Sister Marlene being on the phone, man. You know, getting this information out. As-salamu alaykum, my dear sister. May Allah bless you, continue to strengthen you and keep you healthy. And, you know, stand up for truth and justice so people can know what's going on. You know, a lot of people don't know a lot of these things, you know.
I know.
Yeah, these brothers were totally innocent. In this situation with Malcolm, you know, it disturbed me for many years, even after I came into the Nation of Islam. And I didn't really get peace and get ease from it until Imam Muhammad, you know, really started explaining really what he thought, you know, what he thought happened, you know, with the whole situation, even leading up to all this. So, yes, I thank Allah for people like you still around today, you know, that can put the truth out there so the people can hear it. Thank you.
Yeah, and, you
That's
know, Malcolm was a wonderful person because Malcolm married my husband and I.
Yeah.
And, in fact, he named my daughter. He told my husband to name my daughter. He gave us the name her Kalima. So my husband said, well, why? He said, because she's going to have the last word. And it's the God's honest truth. But I'm just saying, he told us, he named my son Tariq. And he said after Jebel Tariq, the Rock of Gibraltar.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave us the parallel of everything. And I mean, you know, what I'm saying, you know, it just really annoys me and upset me when people really, really, truly do not know what went on. And like I said, the fact that Thomas was not there because he was painting and Norman, they were painting my house.
Yes,
that's right.
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm.
So they had absolutely, they certainly couldn't be in two places at one time.
That's right.
And as soon as I heard that Malcolm was assassinated, I went and told Thomas, go home to his wife because Malcolm was just assassinated.
May I say something here? This is Imam Benjamin Bilal.
Yes, sir, please.
Yes. Greetings to you, sister. Assalamu alaikum. Good to hear you.
Walaikum assalam.
And I just want to corroborate what you just said, because he did go home, and he told me that when he got home, he turned on the television set and had heard from the news broadcast that Malcolm had just been shot. And he said out loud, wow, he said, they just got Big Red, because they used to call him Red. He said, they just got Big Red. And he said it was 3 days later that the detectives came to his home to arrest him.
And at that time,
I don't know if it was from the exquisite job he did painting your house, but he told me that he had arthritis in both of his hands, I believe he said, and he also had a bout with thrombitis in his legs, which made it very painful for him to walk up and down.
Yeah, he was having problems, and that's why he had the other brother helping him, you know.
Exactly.
So, but I told him to go right home to his wife, and after that, and that's what he did. And that's when the police came in and arrested him. And after he was arrested, Thomas and them were arrested, my husband and I, we would always go up to see him up in Attica and take the children to see their father.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sister Marlene, I know it's indeed a blessing that Allah kept you here for a special reason, you know, and you're here to give testimony that can't nobody else give. And we thank Allah first, and we thank you as well. And when you first came on, you were making a comment, and I asked you to hold it. I hope you can share that with us now, what you were saying from the beginning.
Well, what I had said from the beginning, that I knew that those brothers had nothing to do with having to kill Malcolm, because they were both painting my house. And when I heard it over the news, I immediately went and told them go home to your wife because Malcolm was just assassinated. Now, they couldn't be in my house painting and assassinate Malcolm at the same time.
That's right. That's right. So, Sister Marlene, did you have any conversations with Brother Khalil Islam after he was released? And if so,
Brother Khalil, he used to come to my house when I was living up in Albany. He used to come by, and we used to sit down and talk. Because, you know, my husband and I used to go up and visit him. When he was arrested, we would go up to Attica. But afterwards, he came to my house. And because, you know, we knew him, my husband knew him, because they used to hang out together, you know, in the street. I didn't meet him until afterwards, but my husband and he were very close friends.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, thank you. We do have a caller on the line. We encourage our listeners, perhaps they have a question or comment for our wonderful guest today. Press 1 on your phone, and we will bring you into the conversation. We have a caller here from Indianapolis, 317-400. Caller from Indianapolis, give us your first name and your question and comment.
As-salamu alaykum. It is evident that the two brothers were at the sister's house painting. My question is, how could they possibly come up with some evidence about Malcolm?
You say they, you referring to the police?
How could the police or whoever come up with evidence that they assassinated Malcolm when the brothers was over at the sister's house doing painting?
But they didn't have any evidence. You know, at that particular time, I mean,
right.
I've been a Muslim for years, and they would just create things and so forth. I even went to court when it was in court and let them know that, you know, they had nothing to do with it.
Right.
But, you know, at that time, the government were against the Nation of Islam and all the Muslims, so they could conjure up whatever they wanted. And that's exactly what they did. They were after Malcolm, and they were after the brothers, you know, but those brothers had nothing to do with assassinating Malcolm.
Yes, ma'am.
Because
that's
you
right.
Can't be at two places at one time. And at that time, I lived in Albany, so, you know, that we wasn't down, they were not down near the Audubon.
Right, that's what I don't understand. How was they exhilarated and they had nothing to do with it?
Well, come on, brother. You've been around a long time. The government do whatever they want to do.
Yes, Mr. Marlene, you have a question.
A
question for people who don't know New York as well as I do. Your house was in Albany. The Audubon is in Harlem, I think.
Audubon is down in the west part of New York, right.
So how far is Albany from the Audubon, roughly?
It's a little drive. It's a good drive.
Like what, an hour, half hour, 2 hours? What is it?
About 2 hours.
I would say between 45 minutes to an hour, especially like in New York, you know, the traffic is horrendous. And the Audubon was over on the other side, and I was up in the East Bronx.
Right. Okay. Good. Now, I'm asking that question because that would be important to know, but if nothing else for history.
They could not have been there, like I'm saying, because up in the Bronx, I lived on 221st, way up in the Bronx, and, you know, and the Audubon was downtown on the west side, you know, over by Broadway somewhere, you know?
Imam Bilal, were you going to say something?
We used to own some property in Albany. It would take us close to 2 hours. if there were serious traffic to get up to Albany. So definitely there's some distance between where the Audubon is and where Albany is situated. But I wanted to say this also, in answer to the brother's question, in terms of how they could actually charge, in this case, Khalil Islam. I'm not sure what the circumstances were for Abdelaziz's arrest, but Khalil Islam for sure, how they could actually charge him with this is because they have a running record. The police department, as you know, or should know, has a running record of arrests and who has been arrested for what. And they would simply comb through their records to see if anyone has been arrested for weapons possession or for whatever. And then they would just, you know, they mix and match.
Well, you see, that you got to realize that Thomas and them had been arrested. You know, come on, those brothers were from the street. And I knew them for years. And they had been arrested, you know, for weapons years ago. And I don't know if either one of them had been, like, in prison. But, you know, they had been arrested before. Like, all those brothers in the Nation of Islam had all been arrested for something. You know, a lot of them were ex-drug addicts and, you know, they hung out and whatever the case may be. But so, you know, they just took basically, you know, their background. I mean, Thomas had been arrested years ago.
Yeah, well, it was a little bit more than that, if I might expound for a minute, Mikel, if I may.
Yes, sir, please.
And I'm basing it purely on what Khalil Islam shared with me and with certain news programs that we were both there together on. And he said what really served as the linchpin for his arrest was that when they came to his apartment, Khalil had taken the weapon of another person in the nation who had actually used it on another person, an ex-member of the Nation of Islam. And Khalil, being the lieutenant, was responsible for whoever and whatever happened in his cadre of men. So he told the brother, after the brother told him, well, listen, man, you know, I just shot me. He said, what in the what? And he said, he told the brother, go take that to my house. So there was a weapon. There was a shotgun in Khalil Islam's home when the police came to knock on his door. It was not the weapon that they spoke about in the actual case. Nevertheless, the police felt like, well, it at least is a weapon, so he must have done it, or we can pin it on him if he didn't do it. And that's when it began to snowball. And Khalil Islam has told this story to many, many reporters, so I'm not saying anything that he would not have said. I'm only saying this so you can see how all of this is tied in terms of how they could actually pin something on a person, because they put extraneous pieces of information together and then they present it to the public, and because the public is not really a research kind of public, they just accept what people say. He had a gun in his house, he must have done it, and that's how it went down. But as far as the nation was concerned, like I said before our sister joined us, it was an open and shut case. They thought it was an open and shut case. They said, we know these guys didn't do, these guys couldn't have gotten 5 blocks within the Audubon without one of Malcolm's people recognizing them, especially if they went a third row and that kind of thing. They would have had people standing, sitting next to them in the aisle, in that same aisle next to them. They would have had people on Thomas, because remember now, Thomas was also the person that was assigned by Malcolm. This was before Malcolm was put out of the Nation of Islam. Thomas was almost like his personal bodyguard for him and his wife, Betty, and the children. He used to take the children back and forth. He used to take Betty back and forth shopping, and he would take Malcolm where he needed to go. So they were very, very well known to each other. It's not like Malcolm would have to sit down, drag out conversations with him, because he was a security guy. But nevertheless, they knew what Khalil looked like, or what Thomas looked like. So they, you know, Malcolm would have said when he came out, wait a minute, there's a brother that used to be at my house every day. And they would have been watching him. But these particular people were not identified in the audience. So that's another proof that it didn't go down the way they said. But may I just segue back into your main theme for one moment?
Well, let me just say one
thing. I'll listen after I say this.
Well, let me get to it fast. No, hold on for a second. somebody got a TV in the background and it's coming through on the show. You turn the TV
it
down
might be
or whatever the radio.
Let me turn it off.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Okay, Brother Bilal, go ahead, please.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say, just in the interest of sticking to the main topic, the idea mm-hmm. today is not to place blame or, you know, say who done it or revisit the case and all that kind of stuff. It's just to give some filler background information on who these men were and what their circumstances were that led up to their arrest, and to also speak about how they fared once they got released. Now, our sister Marlene, she knew Thomas before the arrest. I did not. I didn't meet him until 2 years after he was released. So most of my mm-hmm. contribution to this conversation was already told to you in the beginning before she called in. And that is that he was just a very gentle soul. He was a very family-oriented man. I met one of his children, Khalil Ibn Islam,
mm-hmm.
through him. And we became very, very good friends also. So,
and, you know, the thing of it is, brother, the thing of it is, most of those brothers that were in the Nation of Islam had all had records. I mean, Thomas and my husband used to hang out together. They used to shoot dope together. They used to smoke together. They knew each other for years and years. You know what I'm trying to say? And my husband became a Muslim, never smoked another cigarette in his entire life, never smoked or did anything. But I'm saying they hung out together for years. They used to be in the little gangs that they had, you know, in New York.
Right. But all that the gun charges, the smoking, the getting high was before they joined.
Yeah, but all that was before. But you got to realize when this incident went down, they brought up all of Thomas's background. It had nothing to do with killing Malcolm because he was painting my house. So it had nothing to do with that. Most of those brothers in there, even Malcolm, I tell you, they all had been arrested. They all had records.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
So one thing had nothing to do with another.
Yes,
I mean, those brothers all used to be drug addicts and whatever, and they all came in the Nation of Islam. Nobody ever smoked. Nobody ever did anything. My husband used to be a junkie. You know?
Yes, ma'am.
And he smoked, and he did time in prison and whatever. Come on, you know? Which one of those brothers years ago had never been out there and been arrested? Most of them had been arrested for something.
That's right. And that's another show for us, because the Nation of Islam saved thousands in that regard. Imam Bilal, you were making a point. You want to finish up?
Yes, sir. And that is just to say that we need to proceed, in my opinion, with the strictest amount of sensitivity towards this whole period of history, because for me, it actually represents a whole different world than the one that we're living in now, give or take. And sometimes our personal feelings about people and events and things kind of spill over into inappropriate areas of our conversation. So I do not want to leave this program having anyone in listener land conclude that there's a good guy, bad guy kind of scenario that we're painting, like these guys are good, Malcolm was not that good, or Malcolm was great and these guys were evil. And I'm happy that our sister Marlene and myself are not painting that kind of picture. What it is that because it was a different period of history, we have to judge it with a different set of lenses. And what we're saying today is that the two men that were exonerated on Thursday deserved to be exonerated. That doesn't mean that whoever shot Malcolm were good guys or her.
Hey, right, because those two guys had nothing to do with it.
Right. And even the third guy, Mujahid, served however amount of time he served. He got out in 2010, I believe. So he went from 1965 to 2010. And mm-hmm. they decided to cut him some slack, and he came out, and there's not very much he can do with his life and livelihood, you know, except for what he can get away with working and trying to take care of his present family. And he admitted, mm-hmm. man, I was a knucklehead back then. I didn't know I was captivated by the message also and by the local leadership who said, you know, this guy is not a good guy, and, you know, we have to do something about it. But if you're in a situation where government officials are clandestinely controlling mm-hmm. your activities and are they able to do certain things and suggest certain things to people who are willing to take the weight for it, then you got a whole nother kind of stew that's cooking on the stove,
yes,
you know what I'm saying? And when you begin to stir it,
yes,
the only thing they want to come out of the stew is people who look like you and me. They don't want the FBI, the
yes.
CIA, and these other organizations to be in that stew with you. And,
yes,
it, you know, stuff will continue to come out, especially with the exoneration, because this is not the last word on what's happening in that or with that case. So we just continue to pray for the family members. And I mean Malcolm's family members, Abdelaziz's family members, Khalil's family members, because a lot of time was lost from their families, from these men being incarcerated for the number of years that they were. So we say in
yes.
my last words to you is that we need to just make dua, we need to make prayer, and if there's some kind of fund even that can be started for these families. I mean, they lost a father, they lost a husband, they lost a
that's what I would like to do.
Maker.
I would like to
so
start some sort of fund for the, you know, for the children and the grandchildren, because these
yes.
brothers were just taken away, and they're putting a terrible stigma out there on them, and it's not true.
Yes, ma'am. Well, let me get
and
my next caller
thing.
Here
that's
for
right.
me. Yeah,
pardon
I didn't
me?
Have a caller been on. No, I have a caller that's been on hold for quite some time. I want to get to my caller. And want to thank Brother Daniel for his question, because she asked a good question. So we go to our next caller from 414. I think that's the Milwaukee number. Caller from 414. Thanks for calling Worth Made People. Can you give us your name and city, please?
Assalamu alaikum. To everybody there, yes, this is Amatala, Milwaukee.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Muslim. How are you doing?
Fine. Okay, I just want to thank the brother for the perspective on attitude that our brother had for serving the time, because I always thought that's one of the worst things in the world, to be accused of something that you didn't do. So I appreciate him sharing with us how he had processed it. So that would probably help me too. And the sister, thank you very much. My brief comment is that the identity of the real persons who were involved had to be kept secret. So to grab up a couple of innocent brothers and put it on them gave them the opportunity to keep the real identities secret, and also the actual conspiracy, and I will use that word not as a slang but as an actual conspiracy to deal with Malcolm. So that's I know you said we're not going to go into all the details, so that's just my comment, that in reading some of the declassified documents from the FBI, it was very clear that they had assistance and had well-placed people. So in a sense, it was the FBI and the Nation of Islam. I'll just put it like that. So thank you very much, and I appreciate all of you. Appreciate you too, Brother McHale.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, thank you, Sister Matula. Let's keep in mind, and we can talk about this, I think we should. The main bodyguard, I think a key bodyguard for Malcolm X on the day he was assassinated, his name is Gene Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
He's noted for the one who performed CPR on Malcolm, trying to save him that day.
Mm-hmm.
Gene Roberts was a New York City policeman, but Malcolm had him as his bodyguard. So so to equate FBI, NOI does have some weight to carry on it. But the infiltration, I think, was you, Brother Imam Bilal, told me that there were like, you found out there were like 1,500 undercover policemen in New York alone. So if that's true, they had ranks of lieutenant, they had ranks of captain. They may, who knows, there may have even been a minister who were perpetrating to be in OI. But in fact, they were government officials. If either one of you all can speak to that, I think that's fair at this time.
I don't think I mentioned that there was a particular number of undercover police officers, but I do know that.
No, you're right.
In the late...
You're right. I'm sorry. It was my mind. It's the brother in the New York area told me that just yesterday.
And that could be possible. But they started to hire a large number of African-American officers and detectives around the late 50s and 60s when they wanted to infiltrate groups like the Black Panthers out here in California and the Nation of Islam, which was growing roots all around the country. They needed people who looked like those people to be able to get in and observe. And as you mentioned in the FBI COINTEL report, they were trying to stop the rise of what J. Edgar Hoover called a black messiah who would unify and electrify the people, especially the young people. So they had to keep an eye on them. So whether you're talking about people in the Nation of Islam or the Black Panther Party or the 5% Nation, these are all groups that had been, to some degree, infiltrated by these police department and federal government agencies. Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover, he was the head of the FBI since the early 1900s. He's nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
He was there when Elijah Muhammad got started. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing of it is, even the incident with the Black Panthers, when they went into that house and shot up all of them, the children, the women, and whatever the case may be, come on. I mean, you know, they don't want to talk about that. I mean, they went in. They had that. The police went in and shot up the whole family.
Yes.
With the Black Panthers. And
yeah.
In their house. And they were just sitting home being, you know, normal citizens. But you don't hear about those things. You know, you just hear about, you know, somebody, what they did with, you know, with Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm and whatever. And like I said, I can tell you, I know that the brothers didn't have anything to do with it because I knew they were at my house. And here again, Malcolm knew Thomas. Malcolm knew Norman. He knew them. And if he, you know, if he thought that there was a problem with them, you think that he would not have let the brothers know? He knew those brothers.
Right.
Norman wasn't new to him, and Thomas wasn't new to him, because both of them, Thomas was a lieutenant. So Malcolm knew them very well, you know?
May I add to that for just
yes.
a moment? Minister Benjamin Kareem was Malcolm's number one man, and he was the one who actually introduced Malcolm to the podium just before he was shot at.
Right.
Benjamin Kareem told us in an interview that he had for the documentary called Brother Minister, The Assassination of Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz. And you can get that on YouTube. Actually, just type in Brother Minister. And Imam Muhammad was also an interviewee in that documentary. But Benjamin Kareem said, he said his job was to go out and canvass the audience before Malcolm would come to the podium to see if there were anybody he recognized.
Uh-huh.
And Benjamin Kareem, he knew Thomas. He knew the other two gentlemen, actually. But
he knew them.
Yeah, so if he had seen Thomas, in fact, he didn't know the actual gunman because the actual gunman wasn't from New York. That's the only reason he
right,
didn't recognize
they were from Jersey.
That's right. And people don't know also, as far as the Nation of Islam goes, you couldn't just willy-nilly leave New York Temple and go to New Jersey Temple and visit on a Sunday. You had to have special permission from your minister to go to even another borough, not to mention another state. because people were there at the door. You'd have to knock on the door a certain way. You'd have to look through the little looking glass, open the door. Well, who sent you? Do you have a letter from that temple? And then you'd get in if you had reason to be there. But it's not like today where you can just go from masjid to masjid or church to church.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't do that.
That's not how
then.
The Nation of Islam operated. You couldn't do that. So they would have known if you were from New York, but they would not have known had you been sent from some other state, Connecticut, New Jersey, Alabama, whoever. They wouldn't have known. Plus, the gentlemen had grown beards. And remember now, in the Nation of Islam, you didn't wear beards. The gentlemen had permanently grown beards.
You had to be clean-shaven.
Yeah. So Khalil Thomas was always clean-shaven.
He was?
But the gentleman who actually pulled the trigger, he had a very long beard, according to the people who wanted to testify but were not allowed to testify. So all of that was lost in the sauce because these key people were not allowed, including Benjamin Kareem, who was Malcolm's number one man. He wasn't even allowed to testify. So you know there were shenanigans in there.
That's right. Okay. So
well, even during the time, I mean, I testified that Malcolm wasn't, you know, that this situation didn't go down, but the testimony didn't mean anything. You know, the government could do what they wanted to do, and the whole thing was to separate the Nation of Islam. And that's what they, you know, what they did, you know. And it was just so sad because Malcolm knew all those guys. In fact, he knew them from the FOI because Malcolm used to be in the FOI all the time.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, we do want to encourage our callers coming down to our last few minutes here. If you have a question or comment, press 1 on your phone. I'd like to ask Imam Bilal, you had shared that there were some other projects that you and Brother Khalil Islam were working on, maybe books or whatever. Can you speak to us about some of the things you had worked with him on or were working with him on?
Yes, sir. Thank you for that. In the year 2000, Khalil Islam visited me for a few days when I first lived down here in North Carolina before moving back to New York and then moving back to North Carolina. I was down here in the year 1999, 2000. And we had an extensive interview, which I have then since turned into a book called Institutionalizing Islam, with Islam in quotation marks, meaning Khalil Islam. And the subtitle is The Long-Awaited In-Depth Interview with the Late Khalil Islam, formerly Thomas 15 X Johnson, one of three men convicted in the assassination of Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz, a.k.a. Malcolm X. So this book is available. I'll give you my email address if you're interested in purchasing a copy. It's only $20, if I may say that. And you can reach me at CosmicQuran1@gmail.com. I'll spell that out for you. CosmicQuran1, that's the number one, @gmail.com. And I will happily, if you send me your address and so forth, you can purchase a copy of that book. It's an in-depth, word-for-word interview on Khalil's life from his beginnings, as I said earlier, in Pricedale, Pennsylvania, to being accused of the assassination and what happened to him after he was released. It's a very in-depth interview, and I'd be happy to share that with any of the listeners. Yes.
Give us the email again, and if you have a phone number as well.
Absolutely, we'll do. The email address is CosmicQuran1, CosmicQuran1, not the word one, but the number one, @gmail.com. CosmicQuran1@gmail.com, and you can reach me at 516-300-2257. Once again, 516-300-2257, and I will walk you through the particulars.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mikhail, may I just say this, just in the interest of giving credit to where credit is due in terms of the exoneration?
Yes.
The exoneration is not a new effort. This exoneration began back in the 1980s with the famed New York attorney William Kunstler. That name may sound
familiar. I remember William Kunstler.
Yeah, William Kunstler began this whole effort to get these brothers off and exonerated, and they told them at the time that it will never happen because there were certain records that they
did
not want to reopen.
He was working with them for a long time, And they and William Kunstler was an excellent attorney.
Yeah. This was back in 1989, 1990, when he was working with him, I believe. Yeah. The second effort was a documentary that came out, put out by producer Jack Baxter, and also produced by Jeffrey Al Muhammad, and that was called The Brother Minister, The Assassination of Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X. And again, I mentioned earlier, you can find that on YouTube, Brother Minister.
Yeah.
Just type in Brother Minister, and you'll see that also Imam Muhammad participated. Mm-hmm.
Right. When was
so
Jeffrey in there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go right ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Brother Jeffrey. You talking about Wahid? Is his name Wahid, too?
Yes.
Brother Jeffrey. He goes by the name Wahid. Yeah.
Right, that's
it. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay.
And then the third effort was Abdul Rahman Muhammad's documentary that we spoke on earlier, Who Killed Malcolm X? So Abdul Rahman Muhammad, he's getting most of the credit because it was under his research that it actually became a full-fledged Netflix documentary, and it was under his leadership that the idea of opening this case up for exoneration became reality. It did not happen under William Kunstler. It did not happen as an aftermath of Brother Minister, but it did happen in the aftermath of Who Killed Malcolm X. So we need to be clear on that also.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And that's important as well. I have a couple of callers here I want to get in. We're on top of the hour at 3 o'clock. I did allow for more time, but if you might have to go, I do understand we keep busy schedules. But if you're able to stay, I do have at least two more callers here I'd like to get to. The one here is from 213 number. 213, is that the L.A. number? I think it is. Caller from 213, can you give us your first name and your city, please?
Yeah, assalamu alaikum. This is
Amin
Muhammad, come from Los Angeles. I was told a story by Brother Samuel Bilal, who was an author, a journalist, in the Muhammad Speaks way back, going way back to the 60s and everything. And he tells the story, and it created an image in my mind that I'll never forget. He says that when Malcolm was assassinated or about to be assassinated, he saw it coming, and he stepped up. He stuck his chest out, and he just, took it like that. He didn't cringe and scurry and all like that, And that image that Samuel Bilal painted for me, of how he died, his last seconds of life, you stuck with me, and I thought I wanted to share that with the audience, that he stepped forward like a man and just looked his assassins in the eye or in the face or however, and he died that way. And I leave it right there.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's a very interesting comment. You may have a response to that, please.
Well, that's depicted most vividly in Spike Lee's version of X, where Denzel Washington, playing Malcolm X, was shown being assassinated. And you can see in Denzel's face, there was even a kind of semi-smile on the face of Denzel, because that's the way the story was told to Spike Lee, that they were believing that Malcolm was, with all of the running and the hiding and all of that, he was just tired. So, we can't read into his emotions. We don't know what was going through his head at the time, but just from the outward appearance, we might say that he was even, in a sense, kind of relieved, because there was a lot of turmoil going on at the time. So, like I said, we can't judge 2021 sensibilities when looking back at 1965 sensitivities. We can't really read those sensitivities.
Yes,
that was a whole different world, whole different set of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So we cannot say bad guy, good guy, looking through the lens of 2021. Most of us were not there. Most of us haven't even spoken to anybody who was there. So, you know, again, I think the best thing that we can do and the best construction we can put on this is to make dua and ask Allah to make it a better situation for us now, to make us smarter than that in how we deal with the leadership. And we have been smarter than that since then.
Yes,
no one has been gunned down or mowed down like that since then. So I think we've learned a tremendous lesson.
I mean, I'm going to make this my last caller. It is 3 o'clock. There's a caller from 201. Caller from 201. Can you give us your first name and your city, please?
This is Zakia in Jersey City.
Hey.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
I want to take this idea of exoneration. You know, I want to think about what it means and how we perceive it. And how do you exonerate someone who was never guilty? I don't know, you know, but I think that's something we need to examine in terms of, does this take all of those people who wrongfully put these men in jail, does this somehow justify or remove their sins? I don't think so. But I'm not saying, you know, it's not a good thing, exoneration, but it's something I think we need to examine and look at philosophically, and our wordsmith can look into it also, inshallah. But thank you. It was an excellent program. Excellent. I thank Allah for all of you who, you know, put this light on the situation. May Allah continue to bless
us. Sister Hajj, you made a point. I want to make sure I got it right before guests respond. So, because I heard a couple of things in what you were saying. The exoneration, it clears their name, but some say it's bittersweet because it never should have taken place.
But the stigma is still there.
Yeah, but then also, if I heard you right, are you saying that for those who wrongfully accused Brother Muhammad Aziz and Khalil Islam, what about their sin? Are you asking that question? What about the sin of those who know
him? I'm asking that question, and I'm asking, you know, just how do we perceive this idea of exoneration? Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
That's a great question.
Is this a yes, it is.
Yes. Well, the ones that actually accused him and knew that he didn't do it, I mean, they have to deal with themselves and they have to deal with the law. They know that they're lying. I mean, the thing of it is that, you know, you can't go out and do any harm to them. They have to live with that for that lie for the rest of their life.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, and that's the thing.
Yes, sir. I would say also, answer to that question from our sister Zakia, that the word exoneration is a legal term, as we all know, so it only applies to the specifics of the legal system. So the legal system is saying, hey, we just realized these guys didn't do it. But the court of public opinion always knew that those two men did not do it. So it doesn't mean that much in their particular situation that the courts now decide to say, you guys were right. I mean, it's almost an insult for this many years later.
It is an insult because
for the courts,
look what their family had to go through.
Yeah, we are recognizing you now. So therefore, you know, we give you a pin for your lapel and, you know, whatever, maybe give you a party or something, and then we forget about you like we've done all the other people who have been exonerated. So there has to come a point in our community, meaning the African-American or so-called black community, where we have to learn to put our own research teams together to evaluate these kinds of situations and this kind of information And we also have to put teams together. I believe Imam Muhammad referred to it as the formation of an African-American intelligentsia. I don't know if you heard that past the noise that I heard. But Imam Muhammad encouraged that we form an African-American intelligentsia. I don't know what all that noise is in the background. But the point is that we have to independently decide who gets credit for what. What doors are still open to certain narratives in our history that need to be closed or further investigated. And that's exactly, I think, what this brother Abdul Rahman Muhammad, I mean, people are not going to agree with all of his findings, of course, because he's looking through his own lenses. But the point is that he had enough gumption, he had enough heart, he had enough guts to knock on people's doors who could have shot and killed him for asking questions. So we have to have that kind of team of independent researchers. So when they bring some news about a Minister Farrakhan or about an Imam Muhammad or about whoever, and they start accusing these people of A, B, and C, our research team can respond and say, no, we got boots on the ground when it comes to that. And that's not the way that happened. And we have to share that information on the street. We don't have media. We don't control media. So we have to share that information in the same way that we shared information that allowed the majority of our community to know that these two men, in the court of public opinion, were always innocent. Always innocent. So exoneration in that case really doesn't matter for us.
Well, brother, I just want
to
say this.
Let us do what we can to help their families and their situations. Yeah. That's where we should be. What do we do to help their families and situations?
That's what I would like to do, help their families, the grandkids or whatever. And, brother, I just want to say this before I leave, that I am so blessed to Allah that I knew, you know, I knew Malcolm and I knew them all, and I know what happened. And I knew that those brothers were not guilty because, as I said, they were in my house. So they couldn't be down there killing Malcolm and in my house at the same time. But, however, you know, I'm just blessed to have known Malcolm. And like I said, Malcolm named my last two children, and I am so blessed that he did that. And
yes,
he married my husband and I, and I'm blessed for that.
That's right. That's very special blessing. And again, we thank Allah for preserving you, Sister Morley, because you've given us information can no one on the planet Earth give us. And we thank you for it.
May I say one last thing?
Yes.
Yes,
I'm just so happy just to hear what Imam Benjamin Benal just said about the research team and us cross-referencing and doing our own research. I mean, this is long what was overdue, but I think it's right on time, too. So this is something we need to be cognizant of. And I love what he said about,
you know what?
That's the court. That's the court's language, exonerate. We knew this brother, these brothers were innocent all this time.
From the beginning,
that's their
right.
Language, from the very beginning, you know. So,
right.
Oh, man, all praise to Allah just for this discussion. It's been wonderful.
Thank you,
I really
Imam.
Appreciate
you. Appreciate
Sister
that.
Zakiya, too. Make some very good points. Yes.
Yeah,
all right, thank you very much, brother, for having me on.
Well, you know.
And if you need me, need me any time in the future, you have my number, okay?
Yes, Sister Marlene. Sister Marlene. But just before you go, let me say this: that I met Sister Marlene through Imam Muhammad Siddiq, and as she said before, that she's glad that he did put us together. You know, he passed away 2 years ago. But Imam Benjamin Bilal, on what you were saying about have an independent research team. You know, there was a shooting here almost 30-something years ago of a young man named police custody, handcuffed, but still they say he shot himself. And Imam Muhammad Siddiq, and we formed a team called People's Inquest. We've done the exact same thing, Brother Imam Bilal, that you mentioned.
Beautiful.
And it was recognized in with that spirit of Imam Muhammad Siddiq. If you knew him, he had a spirit of don't quit. And we were able to bring before the public information about that killing of that 16-year-old boy because he done exactly what you said. And we call it the People's Inquest. And even now, when you read the reports on it in the newspaper, they will put in there People's Inquest. So praise be to Allah. We have a motto over here, and we have to do it in all of our cities. And we're doing it in a gentle way, because we don't want to interfere with the family situation with our brothers here, Muhammad Aziz and Khalil Islam, but we have to be about the business of preserving our own community. So
yes.
Thank you, Sister Walton.
All right. Thank you so much, brother. And I really appreciated the program.
Mikhail, may I say this as the last word?
And if you need me at any time, you have my number, okay?
Yes, thank you, Sister Marlene.
Yes,
thank you very much. May Allah bless you.
Right.
May Allah bless you.
Just, Mikhail, just in the interest of having the Quran be the last word, I'd like to say that for those who are thinking, well, you know, there should be a lawsuit, there should be this, there should be that. According to the Quran, that's the family's privy. You know, that's the family's judgment,
right,
whether they're going to want to sue or do. So we shouldn't be in the business of being on in public, you know, in these radio programs and all of that, talking about who should sue who and how much they can get and what kind of lawsuits they. That's for the family of Abdelaziz and of Khalil Islam to sit with their family members and decide whether it's worth the time, the effort, the energy. Abdelaziz is 83 years old. Khalil is deceased, you know, but he still has family members who have been deprived of many things, including finance. So that's
right,
for them to sit
right.
down and decide. Once they decide, and then if they want public support for their decision, then that's where we should all step up. But in the meantime, nothing stops us from getting together, two or three of us, and forming some type of trust fund that goes directly to those families. And if we can put $5, $10, $100, and, you know, just send it to those people with their permission, of course, then I believe that's a good first step for the community to involve themselves in. So thank
yes,
you.
Sir.
And thank you for
right.
the conversation.
Thank
again.
You, brother. Okay, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you all for listening to Worth Made People.
Amen, Mikhail. I just wanted to make an announcement right quick. Amen, Mikhail.
Sure.
I just got word that Brother Hafiq Muhammad passed away. Brother Hafiq.
What?
Used to work, work security with Imam, lives in Indiana there.
Yes, yeah, that was my buddy.
Brother Hafiq Muhammad passed away
right.
today. I just got the word
about 30 minutes ago.
Yeah, I'll give peace to his soul and his family.
Amen. Yes. Okay, we may do our prayers for him and his soul and for his family. Yes. Okay. Thank you. This will conclude our program today. Within, I'll say, 10 minutes of this show going off, if you have the link to this show, you can listen to it. That's how fast they make it available for our listening audience. We do have other shows on this station, Wednesday and Thursday. Brother Mark Shaheed from St. Louis, he has two wonderful shows at 7 p.m. and 8 p.m., and there's other shows coming as well. So we can get the word out the best we can. May Allah bless each and every one of you. Assalamu alaikum. We'll close up with our theme song.
Alaykum
salam. Words make people. And thank you, Brother Man. Thank you, too.
My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
Amen.
People, every day, trying to do things their own way. But everything you see, touch, smell, those are things that tell you words. To think twice before you step or give advice. Make sure your words hold true. Cause people hold you to your words that make people and people that make the world go round. Words make people. Check out the words that make your world. If your words are jive, then jive you are. Cause those type of words, they don't go far. Think and start, work and buy. From ideas deep in your mind, it's words that make people and people that make the world go round. Words make people. Check out the words that make your mind. Words.
make the world go round. Work, make people check out the words that make your world. If your words are good, then good you'll be. Cause those kind of words that set you free. When thinking starts, words can buy from ideas deep in your mind. You need words to make people, and people to make the world go round. Words that make people. Thank you, WD, for setting me free with words. And people to make the world go round. Words make people check out the words that make your world. If your words are good, then good you'll be. Cause those kind of words that set you free. When thinking starts, words can buy from ideas deep in your mind. You need words to make people, and people to make the world go round. Words that make people. Thank you, WD, for setting me free with words.
Shahada. Allah really loves me. Yes, he does. enough of love. Allah really loved me. Yes, that's true. And for his love and mercy, there is nothing I wouldn't do. I wouldn't do. Allahu Akbar, Rahmatullah. Allahu Akbar, the one true God. Allahu Akbar, Rahmatullah. Allahu Akbar, a heart, a heart, a heart. He's there, ready, willing, and able to answer your prayer. His love is what's going on, what's going on. His mercy is what's going on, what's going on, yeah. His grace is what's going on, what's going on. His love is what's going on, what's going on. His mercy is what's going on, what's going on. His grace is what's going on, what's going on. His love is what's going on, what's going on. His mercy is what's going on, what's going on, yeah. His grace is what's going on, what's going on. Thank you.
strong. Seems like every day that I was living right. Now seems like every day that I'm living is a constant fight against the devil who be constantly pulling me off that straight and narrow. This bottle my throwing inside I cry cause I'm just that kind of fellow who keeps alive first and foremost on my mind. It's such a shame that Shaytan sneaks up on me and takes me from behind. I declined to follow his lead, but this time he caught me by surprise. Before I knew what the situation was right before my eyes, I realized I compromised everything I believed in, threw caution to the wind and preceded them into sin. Although I knew that it was wrong, it seemed so right, and I continued on that path. Night after night, now here I stand, heart in my hand. I'm out of control, gotta catch myself before I lose control. Now if I die tonight, will I go to heaven or will it be hell? I look back at my deeds and I'ma say it's hard to tell. I'm afraid to die cause I don't wanna live eternity in sorrow. I guess I get my life together. Tomorrow slipping fast and I think I might fail. Scared to death about going to hell. Gotta catch myself before I lose control. Lose my life, lose my soul. I'm slipping fast and I think I might fail. Scared to death about going to hell. Gotta catch myself before I lose control. Lose my life, lose my soul. Morning after morning when I woke up, I was filled with frustration because I knew that I'd be faced with them same old temptations as it was the day before, but as they steadily multiply. Guess I lied when I said Shaytan could catch me. I couldn't fight him if I tried. I couldn't fight him because the feeling was too good. But when I think about it now, I really wish I could, because my soul was internal conflict. My soul was in dismay. I knew if I didn't stop, one day I'd have to pay. And just when I decided to turn my life around, I got shot, killed. Now I'm dead, I'm 6 feet underground. Too late to pray, too late to change. This really breaks my heart, so many brothers are doing the same. So many brothers die before they turn their lives around. This breaks my heart because it's only themselves they cry. I had 1,000 chances, but I got caught tripping. Should have caught myself when I knew that I was slipping. I'm slipping fast and I think I might fail. Scared to death about going to hell. Gotta catch myself before I lose control. Lose my life, I lose my soul. I'm slipping fast. Scared to death about going to hell. Gotta catch myself before I lose control. Lose my life, lose my soul. Can somebody please tell me what's going on? I feel so weak, but I used to be so strong. Seems like every day that I was living right now. Seems like every day that I'm living is a constant fight against the devil who be constantly pulling me off the straight and narrow. This bottle my soul and inside I crack cause I'm just that kind of fellow who keeps alive first and foremost on my mind. It's such a shame that Shaytan keeps up on me and takes me from behind. I declined to follow his lead, but it's time he caught me by surprise. Before I knew the situation was right before my eyes, I realized I compromised everything I believed in. Through caution to the wind and perceived him in the sin. Although I knew that it was wrong, it seemed so right and I continued on that path. Night after night, now here I stand, heart in my hand. I'm out of control, gotta catch myself before I lose control. If I die tonight, will I go to heaven or will it be hell? I look back at my deeds and now I say it's hard to tell. I'm afraid to die cause I don't wanna live eternity in sorrow. I guess I get my life together. Tomorrow's slipping fast and I think I might fail. Scared to death about going to hell. Gotta catch myself before I lose control. Lose my life or lose my soul. I'm slipping fast and I think I might fail. Scared to death about going to hell. Gotta catch myself before I lose control.
They was looking good.
Oh yeah, what was they doing?
They was going all through the neighborhood selling fighting H&G fish and making a happy sound.
Oh yeah,
listen.
We're in your neighborhood with your fish today. Yeah, 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 yeah. We're in your neighborhood with your fish today. Yeah, 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 yeah. We're in your neighborhood with your fish.
Fish of our own.
Fish of our own.
As if you got it.
Got it.
Fish of our own.
Fish of our own.
Thank you. people every day trying to do things their own way. But everything you see, touch, smell, those are things that tell you words to think twice before you step or give advice. Make sure your words hold true, cause people hold you to your words that make people and people that make the world go round. Words make people. Check out the words that make your world. If your words are jive, then jive you are, cause those type of words, they don't go far. Think and start, word can buy from ideas deep in your mind. It's words that make people and people that make the world go round. Words make people. Check out the words that make your mind.
Thank you, WD, for setting me free.